With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.
Go loud. Magnified with Matt Cooper. Sponsored by Intact Insurance, the new name for RSA Insurance, and a new way to insure business with ease.
Go loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello, and we're back for a new series of Magnified with thanks to Intact Insurance. You may know Intact Insurance by another name, RSA Insurance. Now, there's a reason for the change of name. For brokers, this means deeper engagement and enhanced product offerings across personal and commercial lines. So remember the name. It's now Intact Insurance, and Intact Insurance has big plans for Ireland. It wants to be one of the top three insurers in the Irish market by 2030. And here on Magnified, we're delighted to be part of that journey. Our new series of podcasts follows the format of old for Magnified, considered interviews of longer duration than the format of radio and The Last Word allows me. For today's Magnified podcast, I sat down with an old friend of mine who I've done a little bit of work with over the years, including once recording a song together, Brezzy. Niall Breslin. Brezzy, though, has so many things going on. He is a musician, and we're going to talk an awful lot about his new music and the music, the role that it has played in his life. But he's also such a brilliant mental health advocate, and we get into discussions about that as well. I really think you'll enjoy this. I really think you'll enjoy listening to Brezzy. And again, our thanks to Intact Insurance. Brezzy. Niall Breslin, you're very welcome to Magnified. It's been a long time since I saw you. I think the last time I met you was yourself and Louise met Aileen and myself down Electric Picnic a couple of years ago, and we ended up having a great chat for a couple of hours, totally unexpected, before you were going and playing with the Blizzards. And I've known you over the years, lots of things. Haven't seen you for a while, so delighted to catch up with you. But I have to know now, having looked at your new album title, am I allowed to call you Brezzy anymore, or are you back to Niall Breslin?
I actually don't know. It's a weird kind of no man's land, which is what I'm going to call myself. I think people always ask about the Brezzy thing. I remember doing The Voice, and just I wasn't really given a choice. I walked in one day and it was the back of a chair, and RT budgets were like, we're not changing it. So Brezzy became Brezzy. But I think more and more, you know, when you're doing the kind of neoclassical kind of piano stuff, people are going, I'm going to call you Niall Breslin. I was like, call me whatever makes you comfortable, because I'm all right with both of them.
The album, The Place That Has Never Been Wounded.
Mm.
Okay, tell us all about this, because you've already hinted at it there. This is not the Blizzards. This is not the sort of the pop solo stuff you did about 15 years ago. Where have you gone and why?
Well, my background is classical. My mum's classical violinist. I grew up around that. She's a violin teacher, piano teacher. I grew up with piano. My granddad died, Bumper, long time ago.
Bumper?
That was his name, yeah. He was a big lad. He was taller than me. Yeah. And
that's saying something. You're 6 foot six. That era, there weren't that many people as 6 foot six.
He was a Glaswegian man, huge. And apparently, me and him look almost identical, apart from he had a big moustache. And when he
and
died,
you haven't been called Bumper yet.
I mean, I don't mind called Bumpers. It's no worse than Brezzy. And he sent his piano because my granny had to move into an apartment and it didn't fit anymore. So sent it from Glasgow to Ireland, and somehow we got it to Mullingar. And I lived on it every day. And that's where I learned how to understand every aspect of music, melody, you know, chord progressions, all of that stuff, harmony. And my mum was obviously giving lessons all the time.
I was going to say, were you self-taught, or was she sitting you down and going
through
stuff?
She didn't want me to. learn. She said, you have it by ear. You're like, it's such a natural thing for you that you were able to. So I was sitting there listening to everything being played in the house, and when everyone left, I just play it myself. So she knew. I read music and I can do all, you know, I went through all the theory, but
you
she
did
didn't
all
want
the
me
grades
to
do, and stuff, did you?
Didn't want me to. She you says, I don't want you to overlearn it. Okay. Yeah. So I didn't. And probably the best thing I ever did. And so I've come back to that, the piano side of things. And, you know, a lot of people were surprised, but people know me weren't. I didn't have a lot of confidence to do it for an abundance of reasons. The album came out of a pretty, you know, those points in your career where you just feel like you've been kicked pretty hard from a few different angles. I was dropped by a label, dropped by a publisher, dropped by a podcast platform, like in a space of a week or two. So I was kind of, confidence was pretty low, and I kind of just went away and I had to think with myself, what do I want to do? And what do I want to come back with? And what, you know, because your whole self-worth is wrapped up in your output, in creative output. So I went away, and this is what came out of it. And it came from a Meister Eckhart quote. There's a place within the soul that's never been wounded. No one's ever got to it. Kind of the steady part of us when the world shakes. So I thought it was a great idea, considering what had happened. And it was a concept album. I've never done a concept album. And just started to write it. And it's almost like it wrote itself.
So tell us about it. I mean, what sort of music is it? Is it strictly piano but nothing else layered in with it?
There is a spoken word version coming. So like a poetry version of it, where and a meditation version where I'm kind of talking through some of the songs and playing them out. That's coming in February. But the actual album I just released was, it's just piano, neoclassical kind of.
What does neoclassical ambient mean?
Kind of new classical, so not the conventional, you know. It's a word, I actually don't like it that much, neoclassical. It kind of narrows it too much for me. But like your Max Richters, your Ludovico Einaudis, these Niels Fromms, these types of artists who kind of create atmospheric cinematic film music is probably what I would call it, cinematic music. But not having to write lyrics or melody was quite a nice thing to have. But I wrote it quite quickly, and then I started playing to Louise, and I could see her reaction, and I was like, maybe I have something here. And then I signed to an Icelandic label, Inni, and that was it. It just took off.
Of course, Louise is musical as well. She was in the Blizzards, which she wasn't, she?
And also a film composer. So her background's film composing, and okay. she'd been doing that for a few years, and she'd been doing it all over the place. And she just has a great ear for it. And I think she gave me the confidence to go, right, I'm going to try this. And then I'd start playing to my mother, and I didn't tell her who it was at the start, and she was giving me, she became my A&R guy, so I gave up on record labels. And I says, my mum's going to do my A&R for this. And that was it. I think it was, it also came, I said this to an audience recently, it was a Rick Rubin quote that sounds offensive to an audience, but actually it's the opposite. It's respectful to an audience. He said, your audience comes last. For so long, you find yourself trying to appease an audience in music, especially because the industry's changed so much. And you're wondering, you know, you see an industry now that people are writing 20-second songs for TikTok. And at 44 or 43, when I started writing it, it's like, I don't want to appease anybody. I want to do it for myself. And what Rick Rubin means is if you do it for yourself, the audience will connect with it. They definitely will. But if you're doing it to appease them, they're not stupid. They'll figure that out. And that's kind of what, for the first time, I suppose, since the Blizzards, even my solo stuff felt a little bit like it was appeasing something. I was trying to get
do
radio play.
Expected of you.
Yeah, I need to get playlisted. I need radio play. I need spot. You get so caught up with that you actually start making things you don't really want to make, which is not where you want to be. And I found myself in that position a few times. So this was the opposite of that. It was like, this is mine. I don't care what happens with it. Let's put it out.
And did you find a record label for it, or are you doing it yourself?
I found a very brilliant label, Icelandic label called Inni. And Iceland's kind of the home of this type of music. They know how to do it. Like whatever it is about that place. Do you know what it is about that place? They massively support the arts there. When I was there, I was in Reykjavik, and I met this guy. Two people said the same thing to me. In Iceland, we treat our artists like we treat our doctors. And I went, what do you mean? He said, art in Iceland keeps people well. Genuinely, and in some ways they prescribe it for people who, and I never thought of it like that. And I thought, right, wow, you know, I mean, it's not the same thing, obviously, and that's not what they were saying. They're just saying how important it is, and the mindset of Icelandic people is music is crucial to the well-being of the people there. And in Ireland, I think we do respect the arts. I don't think that's the mindset, though. It still feels like, Ash, you're doing a bit of music. It still feels like that, and I think in Iceland they don't think like that at all.
See, I would always think of you as a guitarist.
Mm.
I mean, the Blizzards, We actually made a single for charity together many years ago, about a decade ago at this stage.
Still a banger.
Great fun to do. Really enjoy doing that. But I suppose, I do think of you as a pop or rock star stuff. Is that music gone now for you as far as you're concerned?
It's not gone. I still love it. I mean, I started as a death metaller. Like, I was listening to trash metal when I was 13. I was in a band called Ramscar that stood for Eyes Almighty Satan Come and Rule, purely to annoy the Christian Brothers. But I think what I was lucky at 13, 14, grunge happened. And grunge was the language of youth. That's what it was. It was angry. It was expressive. It was loud. And I loved it. I was obsessed with it.
Who were your favourite? Nirvana, Pearl Jam,
Stone Temple Pilots, all these acts, Red Hot Chili Peppers at the time, Alice in Chains. And I was listening to all these acts.
And that stuff still sounds brilliant 30 years on.
Because the honesty of it. But the other thing, what was brilliant, it was accessible because you could play it. So you felt as a guitarist, like, I can play these songs, and it brings you closer to them. So that's why I fell in love with guitar. And I just loved it. I still love the guitar. I still play it every day. And I will do another guitar record. But, you know, that's the thing as well, musically. I'm not a fan. No matter what, I'm not a fan of putting other people in boxes. And I find it a lot with me. People are trying to go, what is it you do? And I'm like, who cares? I do loads of things, and I love loads of things. And I don't label myself, and I certainly don't label other people. So I was like, I can do a piano album. I can do a guitar album. And if I get bored, I can go and do I wouldn't do a trad album now. I'd say I'd be pushed for that. But like, I'd love to, but I don't think I have the skills.
Do you find playing music therapeutic?
Yeah. It's funny, people...
You answer that so quickly.
Oh, it's like, probably a better way of putting it, I wouldn't know where I'd be without it. For an abundance of reasons, especially piano. But I think one of the things with music... Somebody asked me this about even playing sport and doing things that to other people seem anxiety provoking. And I would always say, when I'm playing music and when I was playing sport, I couldn't think. You've no time to think. If you're kind of introspective and reflecting on a rugby pitch, you're going to have your arse handed to you fairly quickly. Same on stage, you're performing. So you're in this totally different state. You're in a flow state or whatever you want to call it, but you're not thinking. It's when I have time to think, it kind of overwhelms me, and that's the difference. So maybe that's why I'm always busy. But I've become much better at sitting and thinking and allowing myself to have all these thoughts. In the past, I wouldn't have done that. So music and piano.
Sorry, would you run away from thinking about things?
I hated it. I'd avoid everything. Or if it became too intense, I'd either numb it, or you'd run from it, or you'd do something, I'm going to go for an 8-hour cycle. That was my approach to everything. Until I started to sit with it. But I think also music, in a way, allows you sit with things a little bit. Even when you're listening to it. Like, I listen to other people's music and find that unbelievably calming and cathartic. And I don't know, I just don't know where I'd be without it. It's been crucial to my life.
Just come back to the Blizzards and your solo stuff in particular. Do you think, in retrospect, do you regret maybe having gone off in wrong directions on your music?
And not with the Blizzards. Okay. I love that. Adored it. Do you know what I adored most about being in a band? It's a community. Community is everything. Like, having a community.
Like being in the team in rugby.
Exactly. But also having a set goal. We're all aiming at this together. We all need each other here. This doesn't work without one of you moving. That type of community. And that, you know, when somebody feels, it's a nice feeling to have people with you. And I used to love that about sport. I used to love the idea of looking at a team going, I have these people's backs and I have mine. That's what a band is. So I loved the Blizzards. And I still love it. I still am really close mates with them. I think the solo stuff was a bit different because the context of that, I was living in London. I had this great job as a songwriter for 19 Entertainment, Simon Fuller's management company. But it wasn't going very well for me. And I was skint. I had no money. And I was pitching these songs all the time. And London is not a city you want to live in without a few quid. And I was like, I'm going to pay rent. That I got to that point and I was like, how am I going? I'm going to move home. And I pitched this song originally for Kylie Minogue, believe it or not. And I pitched it to the record label. And it was called Can't Stay Young Forever. And I can kind of see why she didn't want it. But it had a banging melody. And the label were like, no, 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 but we want you to put it out. I was like, well, it's a good song, but it's not the type of music that I listen to, essentially. It wouldn't set my heart alight. And they said, we want you to put it out. And I was kind of so desperate. I was like, well, they'll give you an advance. I was like, okay, now I have an advance, now I have a bit of security. So I took the security and I made a pop record that I'm proud of it to a point. It did so well. Like, it was, you know, number one radio play in Ireland for months, and which I've never had with the Blizzards. But it gave me a bit of financial security. But when I put it out, I kind of, you know, I know a lot of people liked the record, but me, it wasn't me. And that's what I mean by appeasing something. And I look back on it, I'm like, right, there, good songs, did well. In hindsight, I probably wouldn't do that again. And I promised myself I never would, which is probably why I put out a piano record.
Brezzy, are you too hard on yourself?
No. No, actually, I was, like, in the past, I was pretty good at using myself as a punch bag for things you have no control over.
Yeah.
You, things that you ultimately have zero control over. But like, when you create things for, that's what you do, you need to be able to look back and reflect on them and go, was that the right way of approaching that? And there's things I look back and go, I loved that.
Mm.
I'm really proud of that. And there's things I look back and go, with context, I probably wouldn't have done that. And that's the beauty of being any artist, anyone who's released music who tells you otherwise.
Are you playing the new album live?
Yeah.
So what's the difference between playing that live solo and doing rock music and getting a crowd going, or pop music?
You don't get tinnitus after shows is probably a good starting point. I mean, the loudest drummer in Ireland, Deck Murphy. And Deck, like, he sabotages his drums. He hits them like no one else hits them. And, like, my head is right where his cymbals were. I used to come after shows. I wouldn't be able to hear anybody for ages. But back when you were in the midst of it, you were like, this is amazing. You just go to shows. But then I could feel my hearing kind of being affected. And I've tinnitus in both my ears now. And that's just from playing really loud music. The beauty of the piano is it's just the complete opposite. And I used to finish Blizzard show and I'd be completely head to toe in sweat because it's so physical. But with the piano, it's a 90-minute show. My body slowed down a little bit, and it's a very calming experience to play it. And I know people who go to see it say it's a very releasing experience. It feels like they release something when they come to the show. And I have an amazing string section, string quartet, to come at me. And I've always wanted to play with a string quartet. That's some experience. I'd love to play with maybe a big orchestra as well at some stage to see what that would be like.
Do you listen to a lot of classical now?
Yeah, I do. I've always listened to classical. I would have, growing up, my mum would have listened to a lot of it. And across the board, I listen to, you know, the quintessential powerhouses, but also, you know, the Rachmaninoffs and the Russian composers.
You see, a lot of people of my generation, your generation is younger, there's smaller and smaller group of people who know all about classical music, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think we've been lucky because of that neoclassical stuff. So you've people like Max Richter coming out, and he put out Vivaldi album, reimagined a Vivaldi album, and it was just so stunning that he started to bring people in who may have not have been a fan of classical music in the past, and he's brought them into it. Artists like that have helped. But then I think classical music, whatever it is, whatever it does, I mean, there's loads of research in it, like the Mozart effect and all this kind of stuff. But there's two things classical music does for me when I listen to it. I can really sense the emotional state of the composer, and I find that comforting. And I have a huge amount of respect for the people playing. The people who are playing the classical music that we listen to have trained for years. And I have a lot of time for the craft of that. Anyone who's played with a brilliant classical musician, it's very special. You know, hearing my mother used to play. So that's what brings me into classical music. And I don't love it all. Some of it I find it a bit challenging to listen to. But I also, for somebody who's a metaller, metal music is heavily influenced by classical music.
Yes.
And you can hear it in so much of it. Muse, Metallica, early Metallica stuff. So yeah, I think classical music is something I've always loved. I love it more as I got a bit older, but I definitely, even through my 20s and 30s, I was a big fan.
You mentioned there about been dropped by your record label, also been dropped for podcasts and dropped for books. Just on podcasts, I would actually regard you as almost one of the trailblazers for podcasts here in Ireland, and particularly with your mental health podcast. What happened?
It was just, you know, when I started podcasting, I loved it because it was guerrilla. It was a bedroom.
Yeah.
It was a bedroom and a mic and a laptop, and it was you, and you were making these things, and I found that was the exciting part of podcasting for me. And, you know, when I used to listen to Blind Boy, and you felt like you were sitting in a bedroom with him. And there's something very intimate and comforting about it. I think it then became a very big budget thing, you know, and you find yourself, you know, that like the Diary of a CEO, these massive podcasts, and which have done really well, and they're great, and I enjoy listening to a lot of them, but it's not the same industry that it started as, and yeah. Every industry changes. And for me, I kind of felt as well, I talked myself out a little bit. I was dealing with subjects like even things like 4, 5, 6 years ago, we were looking at things like psychedelics and the research behind that. And I was always really interested in evidence-based and research, especially on my topic. But I felt I talked myself out of it. I could feel myself going through the motions. And when I was interviewing people, I used to interview them like I'd be mining them for information. I'd love it. I'd be like, God, these people. But then I found myself going, oh, I have an interview today. And that's not fair to the audience either. So it did well, you know, it did well. And then I decided I'd take a break. And I might come back in a few years' time, but I think I need space from podcasting because it's...
It was Where's My Mind, was it?
Where's My Mind? And I did a double daily one. Like people, the wake up wind down during COVID. I had done nearly 2,000 podcasts in my mother's spare bedroom with a duvet from 1975 and a mattress that she should have thrown out in the 80s as my acoustic treatment. And I loved it. And this was being beamed out, and it was this kind of Spotify exclusive. So it was really big in America. And then after the first 3 weeks, I got this call saying it's number one in health and fitness in America. But nobody knew who I was. And I loved it like that. I was just a voice. And it was like Deepak Chopra's playlist that I was doing it on. So, I mean, I learned a lot, but I need space from it now.
Why?
Just because the topics were really intense. You know, okay. I know this is what I do and I'm studying it. But there's other parts of my life. I don't talk about mental health all the time. And I understand why people want me to talk about it, but there's other parts of my life. And when you're doing the intensity of what I'm doing all the time, you need space from it. You do need a break. And I think that's where the podcast, it felt a little intense. But more than anything, I couldn't do my PhD research and a podcast.
What's the PhD in?
It's sociology, but it's essentially looking at... Something I hear you talk about so much in your show, and it's because I can hear the frustration in the voice of interviewers constantly when we look at things in Ireland that we can't seem to change. And we're all theorising on why and what's the reason. Is it this or is it that or is it incompetence or all of these different things? And these are all valid points. But when I was looking at, say, the mental health system, but you can apply this to any system in Ireland or any organisation. Why are they so resistant to change is ultimately what my PhD is in. It's like, why are we looking at a mental health system we know that is completely dysfunctional and not changing it? What are the obstacles? When we look at the housing system, like, do we fundamentally believe the politicians don't want to change it? Or is there other reasons? So that's kind of what I'm very interested in. And I suppose that's sociology. It's how does society function?
Well, I have a slightly different theory, which I was only talking about on another podcast recently, that it's a hangover from the crash and that there's a fear of making decisions in case things go wrong again, which is part of the reason why a lot of things are not getting done at present.
Yeah.
But leaving that aside, I am interested as well, the whole thing about, you know, you say psychiatric care and whatever, because you did a podcast as well, didn't you, on St. Lomans, was it?
Yeah, I did. Well, I kind of looked at the entire asylum system in Ireland.
Because I grew up in the shadow of one in Cork, the Our Lady's Hospital on the Lee Road in Cork.
I know it well.
And used to be, and before it shut down, and it's probably shut down 30 years or so at this stage, but a lot of the patients would be coming out on sort of day release, leave walking out. They would be so heavily medicated. Mm. Unfortunately, there would be occasions when people would leave the hospital and the river was down below and they would go and throw themselves in the river, die by suicide. But we have changed a lot, haven't we, in relation to how we deal with people with mental health issues. And I don't think everyone would ever want to go back to the way where it was just incarcerate people, throw them away and medicate them and forget about them. But have we really improved enormously in how we help people?
So I'm speaking purely from my research.
Yeah.
My research is looking at 200 years of intervention in Ireland and how we perceived and looked at mental health. The asylum system is the greatest medical shame in history, what they did to people. And what people don't realise is in 1950, Ireland had the highest level of people in psychiatric confinement globally, more than the gulags in Russia.
Really?
Yeah, we just put so many people in there because our legal system, we had a thing called the Dangerous Lunatics Act. That was the act that we used. And you didn't really need evidence to say that your wife or husband or children were...
It was just the word of one person. And they basically, they're sent to a prison, essentially.
And there were a lot of people were put in for economic reasons. The family couldn't afford to feed them. So the burden was on the state. It's an area, it's the last, to me, the last great shadow of Irish history that we haven't properly uncovered. And we need to uncover it because there are so many legacies that still prevail from that system in our current systems. And they're subtle, but they're still there.
What are they?
Well, one of the big things we look at is the entire model of care. A good example to use is the CAMHS report that came out by Dr. Susan Finnerty in 2023. If that didn't stop the country in its tracks and make us go, how have we allowed this happen to children? How are we in a position that in 1992 we ratified the United Nations right of the child that says every child in Ireland should have the highest attainable right to physical and mental health? We've breached it every single year since. The top line in Dr. Susan Finnerty report, which was incredible, said an absence of clinical governance in the HSE. We had stories down in Kerry of psychiatrists diagnosing children in Kerry over Zoom from Dubai, putting them on medication unmonitored. Now, we're not talking aspirin here, you know, and this is fundamentally a human rights violation of the highest order. So these things are still happening, maybe nowhere near what they used to be. Like when you look back at lobotomy, I'm studying Walter Freeman at the moment, the man who essentially came up with the transorbital lobotomy. We had malaria treatment, we had insulin coma therapy. And I genuinely think psychiatry was trying to help. They were desperate to help. But I think ultimately, society didn't care about these people. And the hardest part about my research, Matt, is when you go through the committal rates of all the hospitals, of 22 or 23 of the psychiatric hospitals in Ireland, including St. Omans, you start to kind of realise a lot of these people had nothing wrong with them. That was the hard part, because you're kind of going, now they'd be completely accepted within society.
So they might have been suffering from depression, or they might have been autistic, or might have had a whole range of conditions that we now understand a lot better.
Yeah.
But in those days, little or enough effort was made. And I suspect as well, in many cases, people didn't get out, did they?
Mostly they didn't. And like when you look at the committal rates of women, for example, an awful lot would have in the records, you know, wasn't long after they gave birth.
Yeah.
Postnatal. You'd women going in, and it was around 50-50 in terms of committals, but the reasons for committals were entirely different. Men were generally violence and alcoholism, and whereas women would be, it was hysteria or delusions. These were the diagnoses that were used. And my mum said to me, a couple of months ago, she goes, do you not find it all very depressing?
I was just about to ask you that.
And I said, you know what, Mum? I find it more depressing if you don't tell this story. We have to tell this story, because people, I hear people on the news using words like lunatics to describe people who break the law. All these stigmas that are subtly ingrained within us. And then we say things like mental health stigma. You will never understand how to reduce or erode a stigma unless you know where it comes from. And if you want to know where it comes from, start to look into the Irish asylum system. Now, the Irish asylum system, there's certain groups we blame in Ireland for good reason. At times, we blame the Brits for a lot, and we blame the church.
Yeah.
And Damien Brennan, who did this amazing research, he's my supervisor. He wrote a book called Irish Insanity. He said, we ended up putting more people into asylums when the British left. And there's a joke that he said that was written on, the only things that didn't change after the Brits left were the post boxes and the asylums. The church had very little power in how those asylums were run. The church, they medicalised shame and gave us the gun and we used it on each other. And so they have a part to play, I suppose, to a point. The other argument people have is like, we didn't know they existed. They weren't subtle.
No.
Like most of the asylums were on over GAA pitches. Like we knew
down
they were
Fitzgerald
there.
Fitzgerald Stadium down in Kerry. Or as I said, when I grew up on the Lee Road in Cork, the Our Lady's Hospital was the longest building in the country, I think, at
and
the
St.
time.
Romans is the same.
And just overlooking everything. You could see it from all over the city.
It was a threat. It was a threat that Matt Cooper has to conform. If you don't conform, what happened is De Valera told the church that, you know, you control the moral fabric of society. We'll take care of the other stuff. And there was a certain boundary of where you had to fit in that moral cocoon. And if you fell outside of it, chances are you'd end up in some form of institution. So ironically, we gained our independence and then we took it from so many other people. And this is you know, there were sick people. There were people who needed serious care. But there was a hell of a lot who didn't.
Why did you pick this particular topic? Was it on the back of the podcast work?
No, I was obsessed with St. Norman's growing up. In my own hometown. Like, the running joke in my town was always, you're going to end up in St. Norman's, or your ma's up in St. Norman's. Or that was the joke. That was the slag we used on each other. And I remember being when I was a teenager, at that point, and I was in the horrors. I didn't know which way was up, and I wasn't doing well, and I was terrified to tell anyone because I thought they put me into Lomans. So I've always had this weird affiliation to that hospital. And also, the people that work there are the kindest people in my town, the nurses and the doctors. And I remember the nurses used to walk the patients because there's an amazing football club there, St. Lomans, which is my rival team. I was Mullingar Shamrocks. But they used to walk the patients around, and we'd shout abuse at them, the patients.
But you didn't know any better.
We knew no. And the nurses, you want to see the looks they used to give. They were so protective of the patients. So there was a lot of kindness there. There was a lot of goodness. My dad used to be in the army, and he used to send down the army lads on the Saturday night to the dances, to dance with the patients or play football with them. And
what a kind thing to do.
But that was the people don't see this stuff. And this is what drew me in, was the humanity in these places, the darkness that was there, but the deep humanity in it. And then you start reading stories of the patients there and how they looked out for each other. And, you know, people who went, one flew over the cuckoo's nest and all these things. When you start, you know, you start to look at what went on there, you humanize them. And the real interest thing for me was there was a graveyard in St. Norman's, and it was a mass grave. There was nobody, there was no markings. They used to be there, and patients that were buried in St. Norman's and every asylum in Ireland were buried with numbers, like they had broken the law. Most of them hadn't broken the law. They get a cross with a number on it, like they were prisoners. And in Mullingar, they were all taken up. And I just thought there was something really fundamentally wrong about that. So we're now on a pretty big campaign to get the markings back in with the families who want their names. If the families don't want their names there, that's absolutely their prerogative. But most families are now beyond caring of the stigma. They go, I want my family. I want to respect my relative who's buried here.
And is St. Lomans in your hometown of Mullingar now in any type of use at present?
Not the actual main building. It's this beautiful building, and I can't do anything with it. I'd love to see it being used for something, a place of education. I don't want to see it turn into a hotel.
Well, Our Lady's Hospital in Cork was turned into apartments.
Yeah, I don't want that. Then after that. I think a great example of this, and this is the thing, you know, I talk about what we're not great at sometimes, but what we're bloody great at. Like, look at Grange Gorman, the biggest asylum in the country. The Richmond was the first big asylum up there
in Phoenix Park. And now it's the TUD complex.
But it's an unbelievable complex. It's a world-class campus. And I'm thinking, Janie, could we not be brave and courageous here and start doing something with these places? Because what we end up doing is panicking and using them for apartments and hotels rather than, this could be a huge service to society.
That said, there are some people who do need inpatient care,
don't
they?
Yeah. Yeah, and they do. Like, this is the reality of it. Like, one of my big focuses, and the actual core focus of the PhD, and the question is, does early prevention, psychosocial, school-based programs disrupt the mental health system? I fundamentally believe, to the core of my being, that early prevention and early intervention are where we need to be as a society. I look at our health system, I regard it largely as a sick system. We wait for people to get sick before we intervene. And I've said this to you, I think, before, our health budget, we should have a separate health budget for prevention and early intervention.
And I will get to that. I'm actually very interested in that, because I think that goes back to a lot of the work you've done over the years in schools and whatever and stuff like that. Try and get to people early to get them, encourage them to get help if they need help. The PhD, just why are you doing a PhD and what use are you going to make out of it?
The reason I'm doing it is I was tired of talking about this and seeing nothing changing. And I didn't want to be this kind of problem admiration society. I didn't want to keep throwing stones at it and saying fix it. And the CAMHS report was the catalyst. When I saw that, it broke me. I have to be honest. Like, I'm not a parent.
Mm.
And I couldn't imagine what it must feel like in the richest country in Europe to watch your child suffer like that. I just couldn't, are waiting for 3 years before we intervene to support them. You know, this is not just in mental health. You know, we've seen it across the board. Like, how have we got here? Like, these are the most invulnerable, one of the most vulnerable groups in society are our children. They don't really have a voice of their own. So the CAMHS report, I remember reading it going, I'm done with this now. I got to do something. I got to bring something to the table. I got to put my money where my mouth is. I got to do this research. And it has to be from where I believe I can probably offer the biggest contribution, which is early prevention. That's where I think I could probably bring something to the table. And I also don't think, it's really important to say this, if we expect the health system alone to solve this problem, we are going to be talking about this in 50 years. This is not just a health system problem. This is a societal problem. It is a social problem. It is an equality problem. It's an equity problem. That's why I believe our politicians are so terrified of mental health, because they understand that some of the policies that they enact causes great overwhelm for people. Look at austerity. Look at what that did to people. That decimated people. And we then told them, oh, you have bad mental health. There's a reason for it. And I think that's where we have to look at a broader way of looking at this.
So you mentioned austerity, and so that goes back a decade, 15 years ago, but far more recent was COVID.
Mm-hmm.
And how much damage do you think has COVID done to the collective mental health of the country? Okay, maybe some people have been resilient, but what about those people who were badly affected by the isolation in particular at the time? Even the mere fact of having to stand away from other people, not be able to hug and embrace friends or family and whatever.
Yeah, I don't think we've even began to process it.
Mm.
That's the truth. I talk to a lot of parents who go, my children are anxious. And I'm like, of course they are. Look at what they've gone through.
Yeah.
They went through a global pandemic. I'm pretty sure children...
Don't hug granny or don't whatever and stuff like...
I remember Billy, my nephew, howling one day because all he wanted to do was hug his granny. And it was so strange. I mean, he hadn't hit the maturity, I suppose. He's an incredible young man. Like, I'm so proud of him. He's 13 now. But I look at I think we often talk about children a lot. We don't talk about... My parents were lucky that I was there. But I knew they were lonely. They missed their children.
Yeah, how come you were with your parents during COVID?
Because I kind of felt that I was the only one who could work from home, and I felt slightly responsible to be around for them. You know, we didn't know what was going on. My uncle died of COVID very quickly. I think in the first month. Oh. Do you know when you were watching the videos of coming out of Italy and we were all terrified?
Yeah.
He died in Glasgow, and obviously we couldn't go to the funeral. I remember going to the funeral, and it was during the 5 kilometre radius thing.
Yeah.
And I went out to the funeral. It was on YouTube, out of Loch Ennell, and I was watching it on YouTube with the lake in the background at my own uncle's funeral, and just thinking to myself, this is insanity. And then a guard came along, and he was lovely. He was like, you know, are you within your 5 kilometres? I was like, I'm not, but I'm at my uncle's funeral here. And I remember the empathy he had. He was like, this is insane. I know. And I think there was other things that happened. I used to like wash my dad's newspaper. And I think there was a lot that we just got on with it and did it. But I don't think, I have to say, our public health officials really didn't take the psychology side of it probably as seriously as they should have. I would argue that it ended up being as much a psychological pandemic as it was a physiological or physical one. And I mean, I got COVID many times. I was terrified my mother would get it, considering her brother died of it. So there was huge anxiety from it. And I don't think we were kind of allowed to process it. We were told to move on like it almost didn't happen. Just come on. And then I think we tried to do as a society is to catch up with what we lost. And then we moved into this almost hugely, like to me, too fast. Especially in music. Like we went from doing no gigs to about 3,000 gigs a year. I was like, you know, gigs everywhere.
And it's like the rush of people going away on holidays and everything like that just to get travelling again.
Yeah.
It's just like, it was just a reaction. It was like a rubber ball bouncing back.
Exactly. But I'm not lamenting it. Like, I think we do, we need to move on, but we also need the process. It's like the asylum systems. People are going, that was a long time ago. I said, if the legacy still didn't prevail, I wouldn't be talking about it.
But is it also the case that we have an awful lot of people who are still very angry, even if they don't necessarily say it's because of COVID? There seems to be an awful lot of anger in society, but a lot of things are present. And I wonder, is that linked to it?
It is linked to it. I've never seen anger like it. But I think we have to accept that a lot of that anger is at times righteous. I think we're looking back at some of the things. And I don't get me wrong, I you couldn't I don't know how you govern that, but there were certain things that happened that I don't think we've been explained properly, like the 9 euro meals and pubs. Like, there's some of the stuff. And we were watching
it going,
I think
probably done with the best of intentions.
I think so.
But
I think there's also civil liberty things that we have to talk about. I mean, we have to talk about, that doesn't mean you're anti-vax. It doesn't mean, but I think there are certain things that have to be addressed in a democratic state.
Well, we have to prepare maybe for the next time something like this happens. I mean, what preparation has actually been done?
You think if this happens again that they will get the same buy-in?
Not a chance.
Because that's the real casualty of this. And I think what happens is that anger, I have a theory on this as well. I think anger feels safer than sadness. It's more societally acceptable to be angry. And I'm angry. There's certain things I'm angry about, and you know, I talk about them and I try to explain them as best as I can. I'm angry about the CAM system and I want to do something about it, but I'm lucky that I can. But there are people who are angry, and I completely understand why.
Another thing, I know one of my daughters was once, when she was in secondary school, at one of your events, which you did, you know, with younger people. And the one thing that worries me about what's happened in recent years, partly since COVID as well, is a lot of the tolerance that I thought was becoming more evident amongst teenagers and young people for each other and the support from each other, that there are large pockets where it isn't there, where it still isn't easy for a teenage child to come out as gay, for example, mm-hmm. and be accepted by all of their friends, where there is still the bullying and various other things. I don't know whether it's just part of human nature that you can't actually get away from, but that the efforts that you and others have made to make people more aware of others' mental health has worked to a large degree, but still hasn't worked.
But look at what you're up against. You can put hundreds of thousands of people doing this work, social media. You can't compete. You just can't compete with it. It's created this. And the currency of social media is division. It doesn't work without it. You cannot have social media if you don't have division. And that's what worries me. Because we are now moving to a place where division feels like a default setting. You know, you can have a friend who's a different opinion to you and not hate them. But I think social media won't allow that. It will divide you. It will create, you're against these now. There's no middle ground. There's no grey area. And pretty much most of what happens in life is in the grey area. And that's what I worry about. I also worry about, like, look at what kids are seeing and teenagers are seeing. Look at what, the thing about social media does something else. It rewards brutal behaviour. It rewards it. It shows it to people. You know, and people will start, they will start acting out accordingly when they see their role models. I asked Billy, like my nephew, who's your role model? Like, who do you look up to? That's sometimes when I look at someone like maybe Caelan Doris, captain of the Irish rugby team, incredibly emotionally intelligent. But he's not going to go on Twitter and say anything divisive. He's not going to. So he won't be shown on social media. I think he's a really great person to talk to about the kind of psychological side of young people. And there are role models. There are brilliant role models. Andrew Porter is another one.
He was recently in on The Last Word talking about his book. He was absolutely terrific.
Unbelievable.
But particularly, I suppose, the maturity that has come in his late 20s now, also as a father, but just going back and understanding everything that sort of happened, his emotional state with his mother dying when he was just entering secondary school, his issues in relation to bulimia and whatever. Mm-hmm. Having come to, he's done remarkably well. You would hope everybody would be able to do as well as processing and understanding their life's experiences.
Yeah, a lot of people need help with that.
Yeah.
You know, they need to work with somebody and somebody that can
guide
them.
And he's had that help as well.
Yeah,
yes.
And so did I, and I needed it. And I was lucky I could get it. Which brings me to another point. We need to make this accessible for people. Like, if you're going through great overwhelm, like my initial overwhelm was some form, I suppose you can call it, post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm not really into labels because I would argue being caught up in the middle of a war was probably a pretty healthy response, that I was very anxious after it. But if I got to talk that out...
What war was that again?
I moved to the Middle East when I was 13.
Yeah, okay.
My dad was in the UN. He was a peacekeeper with the Irish Defence Forces, and we lived in Lebanon, in southern Lebanon, what now is referred to as the 9-Day War. And, of course, I was in the middle of it. And that had profound impact on me. I remember I was shaking for months. So the point I'm trying to make there is, if I had talked that out, and I remember coming home from the Middle East, and not very long after that, Kurt Cobain dies, who was my hero, and asking a teacher in the classroom what happened to him, and he called him a coward. That's my conditioning. That's where I come from. That's how I learned. And who in the name of God is going to talk about anything when that's what you're perceiving and seeing? So I think we also have to respect that society has made massive leaps. We've really moved on. And I see all types, like especially elderly men. And this is not just a male problem. You know, I think sometimes we can let it up. I think women are, when it gets into the weeds with the more difficult stuff, the deeper stuff, I think we're all fairly challenged at trying to make sense of it. So when I look at young people, we cannot take this for granted. We have to keep, like, I think you spoke to Anxious Generation, Jonathan Haidt's work, incredible book. We now have the data. We know. We have hardcore, brilliant, undeniable social psychology data from Jonathan Haidt that is telling us that unless we do something very, very fast about social media, and I don't want to come across like the old lad whinging about social media, but the impact is gargantuan.
Do you use it?
I love it. I'm 45 though. You know, I can make sense. I can turn off the stuff I don't like. I some of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life have been on social media. I see some amazing musical performances. I there are elements to it. I'm not a 13-year-old kid. And that's not saying that they can't understand it. But the way it operates and the way the algorithms operate, they operate around division. And that's my biggest fear, because there's an awful lot we don't know about mental health, Matt. There are a few things we know for sure. And one of the things we know for sure is something that contributes to good mental health outcomes or good communities. And the more we keep tearing each other apart and dividing each other, the less stable those communities become and the more lonely we feel. And another big contributor to it is this neoliberal mindset of individualism. This is profoundly important. This is the one area that I think is causing a lot more destruction than we actually realise.
Yeah, I think that's there. I think also, I mean, I said it to Dr. Harry Barry recently during an interview. I was saying that I'd come across this stat that if you are a smoker, but you are not lonely, if you actually have lots of people, your life expectancy might be more than a lonely person's is.
Mm-hmm.
That smoking can be actually more damaging than loneliness, and he actually agreed that that can be the case.
I agree. And I think, what is loneliness too, and how do we define it? You know, you can be lonely in a group if you don't feel connected to them. You know, and I think these are important things. And this neoliberal mindset that I think is, there's a brilliant Mark Fisher essay called The Privatization of Stress. And he said that neoliberalism has hit the absolute sweet spot of any ideology. It's invisible. We don't even see it. And what I mean by that is we're... I joke about this, but we talk to each other like we're LinkedIn articles. We call Ireland, Ireland Incorporated. It feels like there's an agenda to everything we do. We watch most TikToks that we see is hustle, 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 hustle. Billy's like, my nephew and young men that I've spoken to feel like they have to hustle. At 13, I got to work. I want to have that money. I want to have that. And I'm like, no, guys, this is causing, I think, quite a lot of overwhelm.
What do you do to maintain your mental health? I mean, we all, you know, physical health is something, you're probably still going to the gym on a regular basis and the rest of it, but what do you do to maintain your mental health?
This is going to sound ridiculous, but rest. Rest is really important to me. Like, I mean real rest. I don't mean reading a book to better myself. I don't mean going on an 8-hour hike. I mean resting. I mean really resting. Like, and I've had to work on that. I'm not naturally good at it. And when I talk about rest, it's like three types of rest. There's physical rest, obviously, just sit down on your arse. I mean, eat a tube of Pringles, do something. Don't worry that you're not being ambitious. Are you seeing some guy on TikTok who's done 3 days work before 9 a.m.? Stop. We have to stop with this. This is not normal. And we've only normalized it quite recently. The other one's spiritual rest. Be around good people, like good people that make you feel safe and make you feel. And also people that are a good bit of crack. Like, it's just feel the society.
Laughing is a great medicine, isn't it?
Boy, it's got everything. Sometimes people feel almost guilty to have a bit of crack. I'm like, no, we need it. I think it's called vitamin P, vitamin playfulness. Like, having a little bit of that in our life. Like, and whatever that. I'm sometimes the worst for that. And I have to make myself do it sometimes. And the best way for me to do that is be around the right people.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is mental rest. Like, sometimes when we rest, we feel looking at your phone, the problem with your phone is that you're guaranteed you're going to see somebody doing something very hard.
I'm only checking the time of it.
Oh, no, I know. but you know what I mean? Like, you're sitting to rest and you're going, oh, this guy, you know that meme of your man saying, I do, you know, there's 28 hours in the day, and if you only think there's 24, you're the crazy guy. I'm like, no, stop. Like, this is nonsense. It's foghorns of nonsense. And the most successful people I know, Matt, in music, sport, and business, have figured out that the most important part of their work is resting. And I mean, really resting. And just, sitting on your arse. And don't feel guilty about it. It's crucial. The most important day in an athlete's week is rest and recovery.
Yeah.
Because that's where the gains come from. That's when the muscles repair. That's when the head repairs. Because when you go training on Monday and it's going to be really intense, you feel you can go for it. You don't feel like, oh my God, here we go again. And that's not something modern culture wants to tell us.
Here, let's just finish in something else. One of the days I think you rest, you probably have to walk your dog a bit. Tell us about this dog of yours.
My 65-kilo dog resting. You know, I wouldn't regard as walking her as resting.
Hold on, 65 kilos. What breed of dog is 65 kilos?
Cane Corso.
A what?
A Cane Corso, Italian Mastiff.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that one on the restricted list?
No, and they shouldn't be. They're the most beautiful, calm dogs. You know, any dog is calm. Genuinely,
it's training the owner is often the issue, isn't
completely.
It?
Completely. I have found this really upsetting, I have to say, in recent years, that the carelessness in some areas of the media and politics talking about dogs. Stevie is enormous, and we're very, very aware that a lot of other people might be intimidated by her.
Yeah.
And we're very aware of that, and we make it very clear and supportive when somebody is like that. We'll, you know, come up and pair. She's like the kindest dog you've ever met, but she's powerful, she's strong, and she's still an animal. So you got to train her. But she is a beast. And she's first 2 years, she had two couches. She had a bed. She had about six of her beds. I couldn't feed her enough. She had anything. I was starving one day. I came home and I got two pizzas. No one's like, I got two pizzas. I'm that hungry because I don't know which one I want. I went out to pay the guy the pizzas and I came back in. There wasn't as much, the cardboard was left, not even a bit of cheese left in the keyboard, gone. And I was like, how did you eat it that fast? She just galloped it down. But she's the most beautiful.
So hang on now, how did you react to that? Did you shout at the dog?
Yes, maybe.
Yeah. I'm glad you
did. But even the guy, I was like, if I hadn't have paid for it, I just paid 50 quid for two big pizzas. And Stevie added, but then you just see her. She's just so beautiful and so calm and so gentle. And I actually use her sometimes for people who are scared of dogs. And we come along and let's sit with her, because she'll sit there and the first thing she'll do is just offer her paw to you. So she's beautiful. And I think it's important that we get a little bit more responsible at how we talk about big dogs, because lots of people have big dogs who are beautifully trained, who are incredibly important companions to families and to us. And I think, you know, and I understand sometimes that we have to have conversations about it, but they have to be responsible. And Stevie is the most beautiful animal you could get. But I will say to anybody who's going, I'd love a big dog, if you're not ready and you're not willing to commit, do not do it. It is not easy. And I'm lucky that Louise is such a brilliant dog trainer.
Brazy, I'm so glad that I asked you to come in and that you had the time to be able to come in. I've really, really enjoyed this conversation. Give us the name of the album again.
The Place That's Never Been Mounted.
I'm looking forward to listening to it as well.
Cheers, Matt.
Magnified with Matt Cooper. Sponsored by Intact Insurance, the new name for RSA Insurance. Offering personal and commercial cover with ease.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
With the state of today's economy, it's more important than ever to invest in products that last for years to come. As the seasons shift and get cooler, make sure your closet is stocked with durable layers that stand the test of time from American Giant. American Giant's clothes work harder and are wearable season after season. Their greatest hoodie ever made is made from the highest quality materials that are cut and sewn right here in the United States. So you're investing right back in your local community. Choosing American Giant means taking a stand for American manufacturing and hardworking Americans, something other mega corporations don't care about. From fleece to knit, all in a range of colors for versatile daily wear, American Giant delivers everyday pieces designed for everyday life. Feel the difference of quality, made-to-last clothes from American Giant. Get 20% off your first order with code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with code STAPLE20.